Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello.
Hello.
And welcome to Philosophy for Our Times, bringing you the world's leading thinkers on today's biggest ideas. My name's Dan.
And I'm Margarita.
Today we have Dostoevsky versus Nietzsche, featuring leading continental philosopher at the University of Texas, Austin, Kathleen Higgins, Dostoevsky scholar Oliver Reedy, and critically acclaimed writer Jana Teller. This took place in 2023 at the How the Light Gets In Festival in London, the philosophy festival produced by the team here at the III. So, Margarita, can you tell us a bit about the debate?
Definitely. So this debate is Dostoevsky versus Nietzsche, as the title suggests, and the three panelists try and find out where these two great thinkers think that meaning comes from. Is meaning something that is self-created and self-defined within us, or is meaning exclusively external? Do we only get it in our relationships with others? Oliver Reedy seems to think so. He argues that Dostoevsky's work only takes on any sort of meaning when he starts writing novels, which is really interesting, whereas Kathleen Higgins defends Nietzsche's nihilism, and Jana Teller sort of travels both views. So I think this is a great debate for anyone wanting to discover a bit more about nihilism, Dostoevsky, Nietzsche, or any of the three panelists.
We've got some really big names in this debate today. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe on your platform of choice, and visit iii.tv for hundreds more podcasts, videos, and articles from the world's leading thinkers.
Now it's time to welcome our host, Nikki Seth Smith, to Philosophy for Our Times. Dostoevsky and Nietzsche both regarded the creeping nihilism and meaninglessness of their time as a fundamental threat to humanity. While both were critical of modernity and rationalism, their solutions were radically opposed. Dostoevsky looked towards transcendence for an answer and found in love and compassion the chief law of human existence. While Nietzsche declared God dead and found meaning in human nature and the assertion of human creativity. Is Dostoevsky, as some have argued, a denial of all that is human and an acceptance of authority and oppression? Or is it Nietzsche who is most dangerous in his endorsement of human desire and the will to power? Can meaning only be found outside of ourselves, in the love of others and in God's love for us? Or should we follow Nietzsche and see human will and desire as the means to create meaning? We have a fantastic panel view today. Oliver Reddy is a celebrated translator and literary scholar. His translation of Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment has received critical acclaim. Reddy teaches Russian literature and translation at St. Edmund's Hall, Oxford. Kathleen Higgins is a leading and wide-ranging philosopher at the University of Texas, Austin. Her specialities are broad and include the philosophy of aesthetics, emotion, and music. Author of many acclaimed books on Nietzsche, Jana Teller is a critically acclaimed writer whose novels include Odin's Island and Come, also Nothing, an existential novel about the question of nihilism, an award-winning book that has been translated into 36 languages. So we'll start with our opening question. Is the answer to nihilism and meaninglessness in Nietzsche's vision of human nature, or is it in Dostoevsky's love and compassion? Kathleen, do you want to start us off?
Sure. I would say that certainly love provides meaning in life. Did Nietzsche think that? It depends on what you mean by love. I think he did think that the kinds of things that would provide meaning in life all involve love of some sort, but he was more skeptical about compassion, certainly as compassion was preached to people, as he thought love of neighbor, what he'd grown up with as the ideal, amounted to. The difficulty he saw with compassion is that it's a very receptive point of view. He was far from someone who didn't think that was good. In fact, he himself tried to analyze different kinds of characters in something like a literary way so that people would be able to empathize with them from their own point of view. And I think that is actually attempting to inspire compassion in his audience. But he tended to think that compassion as a project wouldn't work, partly because compassion as a project is so unsituated in general. It amounts to, from his point of view, something like, you know, you go first, no you. There's not really any impetus behind it. Whereas I think he thought inevitably, given our willful natures, what was essential to finding meaning in a satisfactory way in our existence is going to be really throwing ourselves into some project. Even if that project is a kind of aspiration to be a certain kind of person, he thought that's the kind of thing that everybody actually benefits from, if only because people end up feeling a lot more embraced or a lot more supported by people who feel a certain kind of sense of themselves. So I think that Nietzsche has a point in all of these claims. And I'll probably say more about that as we go.
Thank you.
Right, so I think I've been set up here to represent Dostoevsky, which I'm broadly speaking happy to do. I'm not an uncritical admirer. So I think I'll begin just by trying to pin down this association of Dostoevsky with love and compassion. Many, I think, Russians would be surprised by that description. Tolstoy said after Dostoevsky's death that he was, quote, all struggle, always fighting with himself, and Tolstoy knew about that too. Many Ukrainians, and not just Ukrainians, would be, I think, seriously object to the idea of a loving, compassionate Dostoevsky, the man who, at the height of his fame and influence in the 1870s, wrote many articles dripping with hatred for other nations, faiths, other confessions, all in the name of supposedly Christian love that would be spearheaded by Russia's first among equals. And we see how that's playing out right now with the blessing of both Tsar and Patriarch. It's interesting that Nietzsche, who, as you say, rejects compassion, also rejected nationalism. Dostoevsky, whose novels abound in scenes of compassion, ends up embracing nationalism. That's the journalism. And if we turn to the novels, the fiction, which is what most of us will value Dostoevsky for, we see there that, like the journalism, the novels are also rooted in faith, in Christian faith, in questions of faith, but in a much more genuinely universal way that clearly has appealed to both believers and non-believers alike. He's inspired, evidently, and by the imperative, which is not purely Christian, of course, but common to all religions, love your neighbor as yourself. But he probes it, and his novels ask, is it even possible to love your neighbor as yourself? Not just that, is it even possible to understand another person? And in fact, in the Russian translation of the New Testament, neighbor comes out as the person close to you. And all of Dostoevsky's novels are based on, you know, how you interact with the person close to you in your own room, the person in the room with you, in your own home, in your own marriage. Because it's precisely with the person close to you that, in a way, the gap between any two human consciousnesses becomes most apparent. And so, you know, that we may not understand the person we live our life with or whatever. It can become a kind of abyss of meaninglessness. And that's the challenge that Dostoevsky faces and tries to confront as a novelist. How do you create meaning by looking at this kind of very nuclear human interaction? How do you create meaningful dialogue? And here, again, we have the crucial contrast with Nietzsche, who rejects love of the neighbor and instead, correct me if I'm wrong, Kathleen, promotes the idea of love of the distant. Yeah, we can explore this further, but the dividing line there is the question of compassion. But Dostoevsky's compassion is not perhaps what we would commonly understand by compassion, and I'd like to come back to that later to explore that.
Yes, if this was about science, we would be able to test who is right, Nietzsche or Dostoevsky. Unfortunately, it isn't like that. So as a novelist, I'll come in more like with a story, because I don't think any of them is right, nor are they totally wrong. But if we say, why are we here? Because you have to come back to that very basic question to even start thinking about who is more right. And nobody has that answer, why are we here? We don't know if there is a God or which God it would be, or if there's none. We can only, when it comes down to it, believe. Even atheism is a form of belief. And when we can't know why we are here, yes, then you can say everything is meaningless. And I wrote in a book that questions, or that puts that question in the mouth of a 14-year-old boy, and his friends then sets out to prove to him life matters. Because he says things like, the Earth is 4.6 billion years old, and you live maximum to about 100. Life isn't worth the bother, and other similar things. And when you question life in that large perspective, it does become very meaningless to be a human being, you know, here or at any time. And at the same time, the thing is, we do live in the here and now. We don't live in that large perspective. So one can also turn it around and say, in the here and now, everything matters. So I don't think it's a choice between love and compassion or just willful, powerful, and competition with your peers. We as human beings, yes, we are competitive, but we can make love and compassion give meaning. But the very existence, since we are born and we have this gift of life, it's pretty amazing, actually. We can stretch and bend our hands. We can feel some. Even when we are sad or bored, it's quite fantastic. You can feel sad or bored. Where does it come from? And so we have this absolutely amazing gift of life for a certain number of years. We have no clue where it comes from. But maybe that makes that gift so much more valuable. And then we can use that gift in many different ways to give it the meaning that we want our life to have. And there one can choose one or the other approach, but I believe life itself, simply since we have it, has a meaning.
Thank you. We're now really going to get to the heart of the debate, and I'm going to put this to Oliver first. Feel free to answer generally or on behalf of Dostoevsky, as you are the appointed spokesperson in this debate. Can meaning only be found outside of ourselves?
So,
big question.
If I really am Dostoevsky for the purposes of this evening, then absolutely, because Dostoevsky spends the first half of his life, it seems to me, trapped inside himself. He writes many books about people trapped inside their own minds, unable to access other consciousnesses, the double being a very good example. And in fact, that even constrains the kind of fiction he can write. He only starts writing novels when he starts including other consciousnesses, when he starts countenancing the possibility of meaningful dialogue. His most famous novel, Crime and Punishment, I mean, it seems to be a book about blood and murder. Actually, that's done pretty quickly, and ham-fistedly, arguably, by the end of the first part. We then have 500 pages, which is essentially talk. And it is a book, really, about how one human being who hates himself manages to eventually open up to another person, a woman, who also, although we know much less about Sonia, the prostitute, distrusts herself, dislikes herself, feels unworthy, and how they eventually manage to achieve some kind of engagement. And so it's not so much about outside yourself, it's not so much about the idea of transcendence, which I think Dostoevsky is not some kind of mystic. It's the idea about between selves, that meaning comes, and I think it's very close to what you're talking about in a way, Anna, but we have to start somewhere. We start at this kind of basic point, and the moment that we start having two people able to have a dialogue in which they learn something new about themselves and about each other, that for Dostoevsky is what seems like a banal point, but it takes, as I say, 600 pages to get there in Crime and Punishment and in Brothers Karamazov and others. It may never happen at all, or The Idiot. I mean, yes, on compassion, if I can just come in to say, I mean, Nietzsche takes very strong view against compassion. I mean, even from what I've read of Nietzsche, was by far from any, I mean, he thinks that compassion is simply a reactive thing, a demeaning thing, to feel sorry for somebody, for the person you're feeling sorry for. The idea of dialogue in Dostoevsky, and dialogue doesn't just have to be about words, is that I don't just empathize with you. I don't just put myself in your shoes. I bring a different perspective. I see things about you, or the other way around, that you don't see. And that kind of additional knowledge and that gift, to use your word, so it's active compassion. And in fact, it's not even passive, as Nietzsche would say. It's something creative. And I think that's what Dostoevsky does in a way that no other novelist has done. And what I'm saying is far from original. I mean, Bakhtin wrote an extremely influential book on Dostoevsky and dialogue, and all of this, in a sense, comes from that, but I stand by it, absolutely.
And how does Nietzsche approach this? And what would you say to that question of, do we need to look beyond ourselves for meaning? Or is there a sense in which we create meaning within ourselves as individuals?
Well, I think he thinks we can create meaning within ourselves, but that's not, that's no solution. I mean, that the kind of meaning we can create within ourselves has to do with our engaging in the world. And a lot of his aspirations, I mean, I would say in general, he's a kind of aspirant. He thinks the ethics that we ought to embrace is one of aspiring toward things. And obviously people have different ambitions as to what should be aspired toward. And he thinks we just have to live with the fact that there's going to be conflict in terms of visions about how things ought to go in the world. And what we ought to do is recognize that fact, learn to live with it, and I think probably learn to live with it as harmoniously as we can. He certainly doesn't think everybody is born to be a leader. I think he's a little bit naive about how menacing and problematic some leaders can be. No question about that. But he does think it's ideal when people can find ways that their own ambitions and projects can reinforce other people's, and to have people's general ambitions work in tandem, that's a kind of cultural ideal. And this love of the farthest, I think he thinks that it's up for grabs exactly how we envision what our aims are as cultures, as groups of people, and that that's going to vary depending on circumstances at the time. But nevertheless, I think he thinks that's a good way to pursue things.
May I add or ask something? As I understand Nietzsche, when he says that most people can follow standard morality, can be good, but the people who are somehow of excellent mind, they shall just follow, you know, the law of themselves or within themselves of morality. Does he then also consider that those people have like a larger meaning in life or larger meaning for themselves than others? Or how does he differentiate that?
I mean, the Übermensch.
Yes, the Übermensch concept. That is very vague. I think he has maybe the same kind of problem that perhaps Plato sometimes has, which is the idea of a philosopher king. Yes, if the person who were totally well-motivated were running things and had lots of people who were helping think it through, wouldn't that be grand? The question is, who are those people and how would you ever get there? But I think a lot of times what Nietzsche is pointing out is that some of the major contributors to culture were not people that simply responded to everything they saw willy-nilly. I mean, just whatever they ran into and they could see some way of responding compassionately and did. That's one way of approaching life, perhaps, but it's one in which you basically defer everything you see as a goal, just depending on who you accidentally run into. And so I think what he's looking for is something more holistic and ideally more cooperative. And that is going to result in all kinds of discussions and conflicts, perhaps, of ideas. The problem, though, is does he fully take into account the fact that even some of the great contributors to humanity thus far, who he, you know, would certainly exonerate as, you know, it's not so bad that they were not the perfect human being, you wouldn't necessarily want to entertain them in your house. That he thinks is fine, but I don't think he fully acknowledges the fact that some people have personality problems that really are not going to make them ideal leaders, even if they do have a grand artistic or cultural vision.
I was struck by two things that you said, Kathleen. If I could just ask not to turn this into a Nietzsche tutorial, but two things. Well-motivated. So is Nietzsche interested in people being well-motivated? That didn't leap out at me from what I read. And the other idea is cooperation. Is he interested in
I think he's interested in both, but well-motivated, I mean, you could debate a lot as to what that would even mean. I think his idea of well-motivated is wanting to make a contribution to the world. In whatever form. And that might just be, you know, deciding you ought to be this kind of person and, you know, developing yourself in some way. I don't think he has any patience with people trying to just get a pass, not doing anything with themselves. He thinks too often people talk beautiful language about compassion and really are mostly trying to boss other people around and don't have a lot to contribute. So what would it take to really make something out of your life? And I think he thinks people have all kinds of ways of looking at that. That's what he would consider well-motivated. But clearly that isn't what everyone would.
But and this is a completely different idea to yours about life being a gift, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, may I come back to quickly, answer yeah. this, your question?
Yeah.
Because I want to say, this thing, can we find meaning within ourselves? So if you think you can only find it outside of yourselves, what then with people who are kidnapped for years and are held in some dungeon, have no contact basically with the outside world? Do they, I'm sure a lot will lose a sense of meaning, but those who survive are those who somehow manage to feel a sense of meaning living through it. And I don't think you are, you can also think of hermits or so. I don't think you are dependent on the outside world to have a sense of meaning. You can also think of it in another way. At the moment, it seems there's only one thing that we should all run for. It is to be seen and acknowledged by as many people as possible, you know, so we get, you know, hundreds of thousands of likes on some social media, whatever it is. And that somehow is confused with acknowledgement of existence. But everybody exists. If it's only the one who is number one or the one everybody looks at who has a meaning, then 99% of the rest of us would have no meaning. So I really believe that everyone's existence has a meaning by the simple idea that we are born. And then you can give your life more meaning for others depending on what you do with it. You can also be disaster for others by creating lots of problems. But our basic life has a sense of meaning. And I actually think it's essential that we communicate this today to the young people so they feel they don't only get meaning with their lives through becoming famous or seen by the many. I mean, that's
and we'll,
a
yeah, we'll
line,
come back
but,
to this point about our contemporary society and, you know, whether we have become nihilistic in a negative way. But just moving on to the second question now, which is this idea that perhaps Dostoevsky is kind of reaching towards love and compassion might be an acceptance of authority and might be oppressive in some way. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, I mean, from a Nietzschean point of view, which is kind of what I've been promoting, not necessarily, I don't necessarily agree with everything Nietzsche has to say about this, but I think the idea of compassion being oppressive, I mean, why would Nietzsche even think that? I don't think he thinks compassion is, but I think he thinks that people preaching compassion often use that as a way of getting other people to cooperate. Because if you get people to agree that what they ought to do is respond to other people, they're not in a position of directing their own course so much, but instead responding and being in a receptive point of view. That isn't a stance that he objects to per se. I think he thinks, you know, every artist, of course, has some moments at least of being reflective and receptive. But I think that he thinks that people encouraging everyone to view themselves as having succeeded to the extent that they're receptive also makes them receptive to control. And that's, I think, one of the things that he mainly is concerned about in that connection. I also think he thinks that it tends to be counterproductive oftentimes to take the stance in which you are the one who is being compassionate and you're encouraging the other person to view themselves as in a position in which they're not able to act on their own. So you're putting them in a position that is lesser. From that point of view, I think he thinks it's also a way of controlling people, though controlling people in a different way.
And Jan, I wanted to put this to you and also call back to something that you said about that maybe the fact that we don't know the meaning of life makes it in some way more precious. And you could say that that's a kind of rejection of transcendental ideas, but recognizing the value of those as well. But what do you think of this idea of like love and compassion and whether that could be
a sort of... I love the idea of love and compassion, but...
it's not an idea.
It's not,
it's an idea. That's a crucial point.
Yeah.
It's and, reality.
Well, so then I think love and compassion is essential in life and probably something everyone seeks, you know, to be happier. Or if we haven't had it, it's quite evident, I think all research shows, that people become very messed up adults if we have not met love and compassion when we are young, and then might go looking for something else, but that something else may not be so positive. But if we look at nature beyond human beings, I think love and compassion exist among animals, among mammals, at least the more developed ones. So yes, it exists in life. Is it enough? Or is there a counterforce? Yes, I don't think neither animals nor humans are evil per se. It's just part of, you know, nature. A cat eating a mouse is not evil. It's doing, you know, part of what it does. And human beings, when we compete, in our basic nature, it is for survival. It is the one who gets ahead will, as a male, get more females, get more offspring, spread the DNA. And as a female, if you get ahead and get the, you know, the richer male or whatever, you will survive better, your offspring will survive better. So it's a biological driving force for us. But does it give more? Yeah, I think love and compassion give meaning to our lives, but it's not something I think that is the only thing that is there. And then we can say, where does God then factor? Is it, you know, a God-given love and compassion? I think God comes in so many shapes and forms, probably as many as there are individual human beings on this earth. Everyone has their own concept of God. The thing is, if we allow ourselves to be steered of the morality of the God we believe in, spelled out in a religion, we give away our capacity to choose what morals we will follow. And they're all some kind of our agency to choose in our own lives. And there I'm, you can say, more Nietzschean, and so I believe we have the freedom to choose and take on that responsibility. But I also think we have a spiritual side in our heads, however it's built in, and exactly ends up with that belief. And it's better when we believe in something good than in something negative, because it will influence how we impact our world.
Yeah. And Oliver, you said love and compassion are not an idea. Can you expand on that? They're experiences.
They're experiences, and we started by talking about the here and now. You mentioned that phrase, and that is what Dostoevsky writes about. And I'm sorry to say this at an arts and ideas conference, but Dostoevsky, as a good friend of mine said when he was reading Crime and Punishment, Tommy Kashan is also a scholar, he said Dostoevsky hates ideas. And that is what his novels are about. They dissolve ideas. Ideas are like an infection. They're viruses in his books. Ideas causing untold damage because, you know, they might start as something good, whatever that is.
But how can and they develop? God? God is an idea.
Well, you know, the question of belief or non-belief is not the main question in Dostoevsky. You know, in The Brothers Karamazov, Ivan, the great doubters, Ivan Karamazov, the brother, the intellectual brother, his issue is not, do I or do I not believe in God? As you just said, no one can know. The question is, what do I do about pain? What do I do about innocent children suffering, for example, people being killed in a war that's no fault of their own? That's what turns him, and he says, whoever you are, God, I return my ticket. You know, I don't like this world that you've created. And that's where, that's the challenge that he sets himself in that novel, Dostoevsky, to somehow respond to that very powerful challenge which begins in pain. And the answer, to the extent that it will convince some people and not convince other people, is to do with this idea of life being a gift, to do with interconnection. I mean, Nietzsche's view is very vertical. It's you know, the Superman, it's looking down. It's a very Olympian perspective. Dostoevsky's is very horizontal. And that's where the idea of total interconnection, including of animals, including of plants, he doesn't write about nature, but he is in many ways an eco-writer in my view, if one wants to take him that way. Interdependence is where we find meaning, and from a religious point of view, that eventually takes you to God for Dostoevsky, because We all depend on each other. We begin to learn how much we depend on each other. Raskolnikov in Crime and Punishment, the first pages, it's all about, I don't want to have anything to do with other people. I don't want to acknowledge my dependence, like taking a kind of Nietzschean stoic position. And the trajectory of his experience is towards acknowledging dependence. So, well, I'm not sure, I've lost my train of thought, but anyway.
No, that's great, general. And it leads us on to our final question, which is about contemporary society, where we are today. And we've talked about various different interpretations and responses to nihilism, but nihilism as it's generally thought of, might be to do with destruction and meaninglessness and what you touched on, Jana, briefly about a sense of the void and drawing meaning from the attention of others. So in that kind of more popular sense, would you see like contemporary society as more Nietzschean?
Yes, and you can say in the worst sense, so not in the good sense, everyone is competing, and to allow themselves or to get to the point where they will get, you can say, the powers of the Übermensch, whether they have any particular capabilities or not. But it's like, if you can get enough eyes on you, you somehow get elevated, and then the laws that and the moralities that other people need to follow won't apply to you. And, you know, we see with anybody, yeah, famous from Michael Jackson to Elon Musk, and it varies a lot. Now, you know, I mentioned some people who actually have talent, but there are also lots of people who get elevated who don't have particular talents compared to most other people. Everyone has some talent. It's just very incidental at the moment who gets elevated. Mm. And I see that as a particular danger because, again, anarchy is kind of beautiful when it's a little commune of 12 people who have their field and there's room for everyone. It's the worst of the worst in a society where people have to get along with each other, because anarchy always end up being tyranny of the bully. I mean, look what happens on the internet, any social media platform, and what happens in the financial world, what happens in the tech, and this thing that now we have a few super billionaires and lots of normal people who can't hardly make, you know, their lives go around. We can imagine the political influence of those few billionaires. We have created the Übermensch, whether they existed or not. That's contemporary society. And I think we are at an extremely dangerous spot. But I actually think Nietzsche would recognize it also, because the people who our modern society make Übermenschs, in most cases, they are. They don't have better capabilities. Because that, after all, you know, was his thing, was that there are certain people who have that larger capacity for something, you know, and we all want to hear someone play piano who actually can play, who has certain capabilities in that. It just doesn't work in our modern society how it operates.
And Kathleen, yeah, maybe you could speak to that and the positive potentials of creating meaning in ourselves.
Well, yeah, and I mean, I think that's a certain way of viewing the Übermensch, but I don't think it's Nietzsche's. Nietzsche's idea of the Übermensch, I mean, in fact, the term had been used in The Spiritual Connection. Feuerbach, a predecessor of Nietzsche in thinking about God, had suggested that God was really the human spirit projected outside of us and viewed as divine, and that what we ought to do spiritually is recognize our own potential that is dormant within. And so the idea of the Übermensch, at least as Feuerbach uses the word, has to do with this development of the spiritual potential of the human being. And I think that Nietzsche has that in mind as well. He also thinks that a lot of people are running around talking about Darwin and how wonderful it is that we have evolved to being the beings that we are. And he says, well, look at what we're doing with it. Almost nothing. You know, we're basically trying to be comfortable and viewing that as project enough. And he thinks this is tragic, that really a kind of view that he has of the Übermensch is something more like a spiritual aim to make humanity something more than it presently is. So I think that it's a bit unfair to view what's happening currently as Nietzsche's Übermensch, which you kind of were getting at the end.
I was exactly saying that it's a different kind of Übermensch created today by society. Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah, and if I can bring in a conciliatory point between Nietzsche here, there, and Dostoevsky here, I mean, in a way, they have a lot in common. They're a bit like brothers. I mean, they were wrestling with the same questions. It's just that they arrived at very, very different conclusions, and it's lucky that they never met in that sense. But they have certain things in common, and one is this, that people need to become themselves in a way, right? Both of them stand very strongly for not copying, for not imitating. And so in that sense, if contemporary society is taking that route of, you know, copying certain trends on social media or whatever in order to increase your following, that is not at all Nietzsche and it's not at all Dostoevsky. And it's the opposite. We need to be reading these two people more carefully, because I think what they both have of great value to say is about trying to become oneself.
Actually, Nietzsche said that Dostoevsky was the only psychologist from whom he had anything to learn. So he saw a fair amount statement that they had in common, even though he didn't ultimately go along with his solution. And even when it was pointed out to him that really Dostoevsky was not favoring the kinds of things Nietzsche had to say, he concluded, well, no doubt, I have no reason to doubt that that is the case. But nevertheless, I've learned so much from him, I have to value what he has to say. And I think part of what he recognized was the similarity of trying to understand human motivation and the kind of peculiar ways that it ends up working its way out in individual cases. So I think the fact that Dostoevsky presents prostitutes as, in some ways, heroic, Nietzsche does almost the same thing in some of his vignettes. He wants people to not assume that they already know what people are up to just on the basis of stereotypes that they've read in the past.
They have very different ideas, I think, of what it is to be strong. That leaps out at me in both cases. I think we're both very interested in that question. With Nietzsche, it's very much to do with, again, not depending, to use that idea of dependence, which is you know, one, this sort of stoic position, one should not be affected by other people's emotions, by the human herd sort of bleating all around us, and should love the distant, right? Whereas Dostoevsky takes, I think he tries to, in a sense, reevaluate strength, that it shouldn't be that it's not what we kind of instinctively think is a strong person, somebody who can endure everything, who's not affected by anything, but it's actually somebody who may not look strong in many cases, but can understand other people's positions, can not judge, but this can also be understood as a type of strength. It's to do with enduring difficult situations. I mean, Alyosha Karamazov being the best example in his fiction of that. So, yeah, they start in similar places, but teach us different things in the end, probably.
And how would this idea of like God as a projection of the human divine relate to Dostoevsky, and how might it relate to contemporary society?
Is that for me, right?
I would like to, can I jump to the thing of the strong person? Mm. I think it's really interesting. I think in both the cases, when they talk about a strong person, it's a person of character. And so they might define it slightly differently, what, you know, are the preferred, you know, characteristics. But it is strength of character, yeah, that you're not necessarily one that follows the crowd, that pleases the crowd. And that's opposite in contemporary society. Because except from a few who somehow can manage to go around that, like I think Elon Musk is not looking to be liked. But otherwise, most people who gain large following today, whether in the political world or in show business or just in social media, are the ones who try to figure out what will please the crowd or what at least will shock them enough that they'll click and follow this. And somehow, I see that as the opposite of strength of character. So that's what our modern society produces the ones who want to appease or please as many as possible right now. Even if it's, you know, the shock value of saying some political conspiracy or so, but something that might catch in, you know, people. You can lie as much as you want. You know, don't have to have ethics. Basically, ethics is a stone in the shoe in this modern world. But figure out something that will draw in people. That's all what it's about. And they are the ones who then society considers strong today. I don't think that way of creating, you can say, perceived strength leads us in a good direction.
And you mentioned before that Nietzsche maybe didn't have a nuanced idea of the strong man, or that with those problematic kind of opinions around the strong man.
I think that's true. Yeah. And I think but one of the things that he thought was part of our psychology is a tendency to operate as herd animals, as he would put it. So he kind of moved from the idea of the flock of Christianity to the herd, where one person does something and everybody else follows. And he thinks, yeah, we get a lot of satisfaction in that. And yet that is really a very dangerous situation, not only because it can lead to people going in a direction that is counterproductive to the well-being of just about everyone, possibly even including the person leading them, but also because it, again, doesn't involve this development of individual character, which I agree. I think both of them are quite interested in that.
But then it's interesting, though, then we have, as at least in the West, become increasingly a non-religious society, but then going away from Christian morality, we are confronted perhaps again with a different manifestation of this flock or herd mentality. I just wondered, maybe to finish, whether Oliver, you had any thoughts on if Dostoevsky had a lesson for contemporary society, what would it be?
Goodness. Yeah, so in this contrast, Dostoevsky is no way on the side of the flock. He's no way on the side of some kind of transcendent, mystical God either, I don't think. I don't want us to typecast him in a way that is not fair. What would his lesson be? Goodness. Dostoevsky manages to portray suffering extremely powerfully in his works, but he also manages to show how suffering is the moment, to use the name of the festival, when the light gets in, as it were, right? It's at that moment that something is clarified in our consciousness. And the fact that he manages to convey that to the reader, I don't think this is a lesson, but it's something that, to me, communicates great hope in a way that the worst things that humans can experience, and he himself experienced terrible things, a strength is found. And of course, that doesn't help people who suffer in a way that their life does not go on. But I think Dostoevsky is, contrary to the image of him, the portrait of him looking incredibly depressed. And when I was translating Crime and Punishment, my Russian friends used to say, "Are you okay?" Therapist. No, I mean, I think Dostoevsky, as a novelist, is on the side of life. He's on the side of hope. And of realizing that there's strength outside ourselves.
I think that's very beautiful, and I'm going to ask you the same thing, I'm afraid. With Nietzsche, that's a very life-affirming answer to something that might be helpful for a contemporary society. Would Nietzsche have a message to you?
Oh, I think so, and I'm not sure that it's so entirely different from what's just been said. I mean, I was thinking of various points at which he talks about, I mean, he's got a scene where his character Zarathustra is talking to all of these admirable people that have kind of gathered around him. And he said, "Look, I mean, all of us are broken. What should we do with that? You know, find little good, perfect things. They inspire hope. And what does it matter that we're broken?" I mean, it's mostly moving on from there. So I think this love of the farthest, even though once you try to congeal it into any particular picture, can sound pretty frightening, and I think it's been used in that way, certainly. There's still this sense of hope, like, yeah, things haven't necessarily worked out. He thinks that the traditional values that have guided the West are no longer really moving people. So where do we go from here? I mean, it's the excitement of possibilities that I think he sees as really affirmative.
Thank you.
Well, that was an interesting talk.
Absolutely. I love Kathleen Higgins.
She always serves up.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of Philosophy for Our Times. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe on your platform of choice, and visit ii.tv for hundreds more podcasts, videos, and articles from the world's leading thinkers.